We've been thinking for the last few weeks about the two disciples who left Jerusalem and walked to Emmaus on that same day that Jesus rose from the dead. It was the first day of the week. Jesus had been executed, crucified. His body had been buried in a tomb 3 days earlier. But then on that first day of the week, a group of women went to the tomb. They found it open. They found the body had gone. They were met by two angels who told them, "He's not here, he is risen." They told the disciples, those women told the disciples what they'd seen and heard. The disciples didn't believe them. Some of them ran to the tomb. They found it just as the women had said. They didn't know what to think. But two of the disciples, at least, didn't want to stay around to find out what had happened, to find out what all this meant. They decided they'd had enough. They weren't going to stay in Jerusalem any longer. So those two disciples headed off to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles away. And on the way, Jesus met them. They didn't recognize him, but he stayed with them all the way to Emmaus. He talked with them. He showed them from the Old Testament scriptures that the Messiah had to suffer. He had to die and then rise again in his glory. These two disciples, one of them was called Cleopas, we don't know the name of the other, invited Jesus into their home. They sat down with him for a meal, and Jesus took charge. He blessed the bread. He broke it in his hands. He served it to them, and they recognized him. And then he vanished from their sight. And straight away then, these two disciples knew that they had to go back to Jerusalem. So they got up, and they walked the 7 miles back again that same evening to rejoin the other disciples. They found them gathered together, the 11 apostles and a whole circle of Jesus' followers with them. These two disciples, they walk in to the room where the others are gathered. And they find they're walking into a scene of great excitement and joy. Why? Because the other disciples already knew the wonderful truth that Jesus had returned from the dead. He'd already appeared to Simon Peter. "The Lord has risen indeed. He's appeared to Simon Peter." That's what they were told. And then these two tell their story, how Jesus had joined them on the road, how they'd recognized him when he broke the bread and showed them his hands. The Bible says every matter must be established out of the mouth of two or three witnesses. Well, Simon Peter had told his story. "Jesus appeared to me." And these two now tell their story. And the other disciples have no doubt it's true. Jesus really had returned from the dead. And as they were talking about these things, Jesus himself stood among them. That's what Luke tells us in verse 36. Jesus himself stood among them. We're not told how it happened. Did they actually see Jesus appearing before their eyes? One moment he's not there, and the next they just see him appear? Or was it that one after another they realized that he was just there? You know how that can happen. Let's say you've got a schoolroom full of noisy, chattering, rowdy school children. And the break is just coming to an end, and they're all on their feet, and some of them are playing games, and some of them are showing one another pictures on their mobile phones, and some of them are discussing last night's match. and then the teacher comes into the room. And none of them actually notice the moment when he walks in. But one by one, they become aware of the fact that he's there. And they fall silent, and they start moving towards their desks. And you're left with just one little group of three or four who've got their backs to the door and who are arguing with each other so loudly that they don't notice that everyone else has already shut up. And then one of that little group realises that everyone else in the room is actually sitting down. And he looks round and he sees the teacher, and he nudges the others. And there's always one who's still talking at the top of his voice when everyone else has finally fallen silent. And suddenly that one realises that he's talking in a room of silent people. And his voice sounds so loud. And then he looks around and sees the teacher. And then the teacher, if he's like the teachers I had, just says, "Good morning, Smith, or Jones, or Reese. Would you like to sit down?" And Smith hurries sheepishly to his place. I imagine it like that. The scene in that room must have been like a noisy classroom. Dozens of excited people all talking at once, all asking questions. They're not all sitting in rows, facing the same direction, are they? So that they all see the Lord appear at the same moment. But bit by bit, the awareness spreads through the room. There's somebody in the room who wasn't there 5 minutes ago. Someone very special. Someone they all recognize. Jesus himself is standing among them. That's how I imagine it, at least. Bit by bit, the crowd becomes silent, and they're all gazing open-mouthed at the figure who's standing there among them. And then he speaks wonderful words. "Peace to you." The great greeting. Shalom. Shalom to you. Jesus has returned from the dead to bring them peace. There's no one word in English that expresses the meaning of that word as it was used in Bible times. When we talk about peace, we usually mean something negative. In English, peace is a statement about something that isn't there. It can mean there isn't conflict. If I said, "Europe's been at peace for the last 50 years, it would just mean there's been no war. It wouldn't be true, but you would understand what I meant. Or it can mean there isn't noise. If I say to my children, "Please just give me some peace," I just mean I want there to be no noise. Or it can mean there's no worrying going on. When I knew she'd arrived safely, I felt some peace at last. I just mean that I'm no longer worrying. Well, it's lovely to live without conflict or noise or worry. But when the Bible talks about peace, it means so much more than that. It means something positive. It means that you're living life as it's supposed to be lived. It means that there's a life that's full and satisfying and whole. It means sharing God's own life. God is the God of peace. A God who knows joy and delight in his own being. Between Father and Son and Holy Spirit, there is always eternal harmony. And that means peace. These three persons are always delighting in one another. And this God created human beings to enjoy him. And to enjoy one another. And to enjoy his world. And that's what the Bible means by peace. That's what it means when God gives his people peace. And that's the blessing that Jesus was calling down upon his disciples. These people had spent the last 3 days in a nightmare world. For 3 days they'd been heartbroken and bewildered and hopeless. Their world fell apart when Jesus died. And now here is Jesus in their midst, and he's saying to them, I bring you peace. I have come back so that you will have peace. Listen, if you are a believer, if you're a follower, a truster in Jesus, please just take in those words now. If you remember nothing else from this morning, please take those words away with you. Jesus came to his disciples, and the first words he said to them were, "Peace to you." This is God's Son speaking. He's returned victorious from the dead. And he's speaking to all his disciples. And he's not just saying some friendly words. It's not a greeting like you have on a greeting card. Have a happy birthday. He's pronouncing a solemn blessing. The mighty one, the victorious one, the Lord of life and death, of time and eternity, is calling down peace upon them. He's guaranteeing that they will have peace. If Jesus says peace to you, then peace will come to you. Now your life may be very far from that at this point in time. Maybe your life today is a life of crisis and stress and frightening situations and pain and conflict, and that's all you can see ahead of you. But I want you to believe Jesus' words. He has said, peace to you. And by saying those words, he has guaranteed to you as a believer that one day you will have peace. One day, every stress and every conflict and every temptation and every hurt will be over. He will have wiped every tear away from your eyes. One day you will live life the way it's supposed to be lived, the way you were created to live life. One day every single bit of you will be satisfied. You're lonely now, maybe, but one day you will be drenched with love, God's love, and the love of every other creature in God's universe. Maybe now you're struggling physically. Well, one day your body is going to be radiant with energy and power, God's power bursting out of you. Maybe now you're frustrated because you've got gifts that you never have any opportunity to use, dreams that are always blocked. Well, one day all your dreams are going to be fulfilled. Now you're battling against thoughts that crowd into your mind and confuse you and hurt you and shame you. But one day your mind will be a clear river of pure and grand and holy and joyful thoughts. You're going to have peace because Jesus said it. He came back from the dead and said to all his disciples, peace be to you. So, the disciples saw the most wonderful sight in the world. Jesus, risen from the dead, standing among them. And they heard the most wonderful words in the world. Peace to you. Jesus' guarantee of their salvation and their everlasting joy. How did the disciples react? What would you expect to read at this point. And the disciples were filled with joy beyond words. And the disciples burst into praise and thanksgiving. And the disciples threw themselves at Jesus' feet in wonder and gladness. Well, you might have thought so, but that isn't what happened. Verse 37, they were startled and frightened. They thought they saw a spirit. I'm sure they recognized Jesus, but they thought that what they were seeing was just Jesus' disembodied spirit. And they were shocked and scared. Now, we need to understand what was going on in their minds. Remember, all these folk were Jewish. They knew the Old Testament, and they knew what the rabbis had said. Supposing you had asked a Jewish man, what happens when you die? Well, most of them would have given a very simple answer. You're dead. Your spirit and your body are separated from each other. Your body is buried and it rots away in the ground. Your spirit goes into the place, into the realm of the dead. They called that place Sheol, or if they were talking in Greek, they called it Hades. Spirits in Hades or Sheol were conscious. They were conscious in some way. They could think, they could speak, they could feel happiness, or they could feel pain. But they weren't alive. They no longer belonged in this world. They belonged in the realm of the dead. Some of those spirits were safe and happy. Others were wretched. That's where you get, isn't it, in Jesus' story of the rich man and Lazarus. And the wicked rich man and Lazarus, they're both in the same place. They can see one another. Abraham's in the same place. The rich man, wicked as he is, can actually talk to Abraham. He can appeal to him. There's a great division, a great gulf between the wicked rich man and Abraham and the poor man. But they can talk across the division. They're both in Hades. Neither of them belongs in this world. The rich man asks Abraham if Lazarus could be allowed to come back to this world to warn his brothers. But Abraham says, no, that's not allowed. All the dead are there in Hades. But then most Jewish people would have added, it is possible for people here in this world to make contact with the dead who are in Hades. There were people who specialized in doing that. Mediums, necromancers. They claimed that they could contact the spirits in Hades. They could get information or help from them. It was absolutely forbidden by God in his law. But many people still believed it was possible and they tried to do it. That's why Isaiah, for example, has to warn people so sternly against it. Isaiah says, when they say to you, inquire of the mediums and necromancers who chirp and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Should they inquire of the dead on behalf of the living? The souls in Sheol, the souls in Hades are the dead. Living people, says Isaiah, people who live in the body in this world shouldn't be seeking help from the dead. But there were plenty of people who tried to do it. And worse than that, there were people who tried to actually bring back spirits from Hades, from Sheol. The great example of this is the witch of Endor. In 1 Samuel 28, Saul goes to her And he says, divine for me by a spirit. I want you to contact a spirit for me. I want you to get information from a spirit, from one of the spirits of the dead. I want you, says Saul, I want you to bring him up for me, whomever I shall name to you. Saul wanted the witch to bring up the spirit of Samuel from the dead. Now, what did the disciples think when Jesus came to them in that room in Jerusalem? They thought he was just a spirit come up from the dead. A spirit separated from the body. A strange being, half alive and half dead. And they found that thought terrifying. When God created human beings, he created us as creatures with a warm, breathing, touchable, flesh and bone body. He made Adam out of the soil, out of the warm, solid earth. And then he breathed the breath of life into Adam's nostrils, and Adam became a living person. That's what human beings are supposed to be. We're made to live in the body, to walk in the sunshine, to see with our eyes, to dig in the soil, to eat, to drink, to sleep under the stars, to play with the animals, to hug one another, to lift hands to God in worship, to work for 6 days and to rest on the seventh. We're not made for a ghostly, shadowy existence drifting round, unable to touch, to handle, to feel. If a spirit came back from Hades into this world, stripped of its body, it wouldn't be alive as you or I are alive. It wouldn't be fully human. It would just be a phantom, a ghost, robbed of all the capacity to interact with the world and with people. And in the moment when they saw Jesus, they thought that that's what they were seeing. A phantom. Not a real, solid, living man. But a ghost. And they were terrified. Now, that's not what the angels said to the women, is it? The angels didn't say to the women, well, Jesus is still dead, but God has allowed his spirit to come back. Verse 5, one of the angels said, why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. And by using the word risen, the angel was saying his body has been raised. He's not here in the tomb. There's no point in looking for him here. He's alive, body and spirit. His spirit isn't in Hades. His spirit and his body are reunited. He is really, fully, totally alive. The angel was telling the women, when you meet Jesus again, you'll be meeting a man who's alive, body and spirit. He has risen. We don't know much about what happened when Jesus appeared to Simon Peter. But Simon must have known that Jesus had returned, not just as a spirit, but in the body. Or else the disciples wouldn't have said to the two, the Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. And certainly when Jesus appeared to Cleopas and his companion, it was obvious that he wasn't just a spirit. He took the bread in his hands. He broke it. He handed the bread to them. He was no phantom. But now, when the whole crowd of disciples see Jesus here, their first thought is, he's a spirit. He's a phantom. He's a ghost. And their only feeling is one of horror and fear. Instead of rushing at him with joy and delight, they recoil, they edge away from him. You can understand, can't you, why they jumped to that conclusion. The very fact that he's just appeared among them. The other Gospels tell us that the door of the room was locked. Well, if he has a body, if he's solid, how can he just have appeared in the room? In fact, how could he have got here at all? Cleopas has just told us that they were together with him in Emmaus 2 hours ago. And Cleopas has just rushed back here. And he didn't see Jesus anywhere on the road coming back. So how did Jesus get here? Only a spirit can come and go like this. I mean, all right, Cleopas told us that Jesus broke bread, but he also told us that Jesus just vanished from sight. So he can't have been real. He can't have been solid. He must have been some sort of phantom, just a strange apparition. What strange up and down creatures we human beings are. What a strange up and down thing our faith is. One moment the crowd of disciples are saying, the Lord has risen indeed. He really has returned from the dead. He's appeared to Simon. And the next they're saying, oh, he's just a phantom. They're longing to see him, and yet when they do, they're dismayed and they're frightened out of their wits. Because he's come in a way that they don't understand. And even when he says, peace to you, they feel threatened, they don't feel comforted. Jesus understood. Jesus always understands. Jesus understands our muddle-mindedness and our unnecessary fears and our wavering faith. And Jesus is very patient. He's very kind. Verse 38, Jesus said to them, why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? I love the way Jesus puts that last phrase. He asked, why do doubts arise in your hearts? Jesus understands that it is like that with us. Yeah, there are some people who choose to have doubts. They deliberately dwell on hard questions and painful situations. But it wasn't like that for the disciples. And it isn't like that for us very often. The doubts just rise in our hearts. They rise spontaneously. We don't choose them. We don't welcome them. We don't deliberately harbour them. They're intruders. They gate crash our minds. We don't know how to kick them out. Well, Jesus isn't going to blame them for the doubts that have risen in their hearts. No, he's going to resolve those doubts. Look, he says, see my hands, see my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see. He says to them, go on, go on. You're allowed to look. Can you see? Can you see those wounds? Go on, you're allowed to touch. And I imagine that one after another, the disciples do come closer and they touch those wounded hands and they kneel down to touch those wounded feet. A spirit does not have flesh and bones, says Jesus, as you can see that I have. The wounds were still open. The torn flesh, the bone was still visible. This was no phantom. This was the same flesh and bone body that had been nailed to the cross. But wonderfully, fully, humanly alive. Go on. Feel me, says Jesus. It really is me. Too good to be true. It's not some phantom. It's not a ghost escaped from Hades. Or even an apparition sent down from heaven. This is Jesus. Our Jesus. The same Jesus who tramped the roads of Galilee with his disciples. The Jesus who climbed the hills with them. The Jesus who slept in the stern of their boat. The Jesus who washed their feet with his own hands before the last meal. Jesus was back with them as a man of flesh and bones. It really did seem to them too good to be true. Verse 41, they still disbelieved, we're told. But not now through horror, not now through fear. They disbelieved for sheer joy. They were marveling, they couldn't take it in. So Jesus gives them the final proof. He asked them, have you anything to eat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish. And he took it and he ate it in front of them. No ghost eats fish. This is a man with teeth and tongue and stomach and digestive system. This is a man who could ride a bike or play rugby or lay a course of bricks. Jesus, no ethereal phantom presence, a real man. But a man who body and soul has escaped death forever. A man who has already begun to live in the body the life of the world to come. Now, think about this. Where did the disciples go wrong? Why did they jump to the conclusion that they did when they saw Jesus? I suppose it was because they had an idea fixed in their mind. They thought, if a person has a body, that body has to be limited in the way our bodies are. So if Jesus can come into a locked room, if he can appear and disappear at will, if he can move so quickly from one place to another, well then he can't have a real body. He must be a phantom. Do you see, as far as they're concerned, there are only two possibilities. Either one, no body, just a spirit. Or two, a body that's limited like our bodies. That seemed to them logical. It's odd, but if you remember, it's exactly the same false logic that the Sadducees used when they debated the resurrection with Jesus earlier. Either one, in the afterlife, no body, just a spirit. Or two, a body just like our bodies here, so that we still need marriage. It's odd that after listening to that debate, Jesus' disciples still fell into the same trap. The fact is that there is the third wonderful possibility. A body that's truly human, truly physical, but has escaped from the limitations that we are subject to. Paul explains that in 1 Corinthians 15, doesn't he? There were Christians in Corinth who were falling into just the same logical trap once more. They said, in the world to come, believers will just be spirits. They won't have bodies. And when Paul said, no, believers will be raised, body and soul. Soul and body. They asked, well, with what sort of bodies? They sneered at the idea that these bodies could ever be right for the world to come. Because for them, if you've got a body at all, it's got to have limitations. It's got to have all the problems of the bodies we've got now. To which Paul answered, it's 1 Corinthians 15:36, you foolish person. And Paul goes on then to use the picture of a seed that grows into a plant. And the seed and the plant are the same organism, but at different stages. When you see a full-grown plant, you're seeing that little seed you planted, but wonderfully transformed. Well, in the same way, the body that we'll have in the world to come will still be this body, but wonderfully transformed. Paul says, the glory of the heavenly body is of one kind, the glory of the earthly body is of another kind. The body we have in this world is so limited. It's perishable. It's shameful in lots of ways. It's weak. It's natural. But the body that we'll have when we're raised will be imperishable and glorious and powerful and full of God's Spirit. Well, when Jesus appeared to his disciples, he appeared in a real solid human body. And yet it was already free from many of the limitations with which he'd lived for the past 30 odd years. And when Jesus ascended into heaven, he took with him that real solid human body. And yet as he ascended to the throne, that body was glorified yet further, glorified beyond all imagination. The man Jesus today sits on the throne of the universe. His body has been wonderfully, gloriously transformed, but it's still the same body with which he lived here in this world. It's still a real human flesh and bone body. This is just so, so important to grasp for us as believers. If we don't take this in, we're going to be left with two problems. Number one, we're going to find it hard to love the Lord Jesus. If we know our Bibles at all, we know the doctrine in our heads. Jesus is both God and man. But in practice, I'm afraid that many believers don't think of Jesus as a real man. We find it easier to think of him as God than to think of him as a real flesh and bones man, who smiles and laughs and frowns and has a sense of humour and enjoys things and loves to have beautiful things around him. So we reverence him and we cry to him in our needs and we worship him, but we find it hard to love him as we would love our brother, as we would love our friend. When the disciples had Jesus with them here on earth, they loved this man. They didn't just love a spiritual force of goodness. They loved a man. They loved the way he talked, and the way he smiled, and the way that at times he teased them, and the funny stories he told. As well as loving the fierce anger with which he broke out against hypocrisy and cruelty, and loving the gentleness with which he dealt with repentant sinners. They loved the fact that he wasn't ever putting on an apron and washing someone's feet. They loved the fact that he had such skill in his carpenter's hands that he could mend a broken chair or a mast for a boat. They loved him, the man they knew. And when he came back from the dead, he wanted them to know that he was still the same person. See my hands and feet, that it's I myself. Still the same man. Still able to enjoy a meal of broiled fish. Still capable of laying a fire and cooking fish for them. You can read about that in John's Gospel. And after he returned to heaven, When years later Simon Peter and Andrew and Matthew and the rest talked about Jesus, they weren't thinking just about a spiritual presence. They were remembering that man. And when they talked about loving Jesus, they meant that they missed him. And they were looking forward to seeing him again. Now, I only know that. I only know that man through their eyes. Think about a family where there's a cluster of boys in the family who all adore their oldest brother. They all think he's wonderful. But then he's called up to serve in the forces. And he's away from home for years. But during those years, another little boy is born into the family. And he's never seen his oldest brother. But he hears all about him from them. They tell him all these wonderful stories about Big Brother. They share all their memories of him. And he learns to love Big Brother by listening to them. He's so proud that this brother is his brother too. And he looks forward to meeting him one day. And of course, when Big Brother writes home, he writes to him as much as to the rest of them. Because they really are brothers. Well, I'm in the position of that little brother. Everything I know about the man Jesus, I know from Jesus' disciples. But it is very important to me to know that he's a man. And that he is my brother. And one day I'll see him. And he'll hug me just like he hugs all the rest of the family. If Jesus were just a spirit, I couldn't love him in the same way. I love him because Jesus, risen from the dead, is still one of us. He's got everything in common with us. Except our sin. And then the second reason why this is so important. If we don't take this in, we're going to find it hard to look forward to the world to come. Again, many Christians find it hard to think of the world to come as a real place. They sort of think of it as a strange, mystical, ethereal world, like a giant winter wonderland in one of the department stores. All tinsel and silver, and inhabited by strange spiritual beings. They can't imagine doing anything there. Well, Jesus rose in the body, a flesh and bones body. And believers are going to be like him, flesh and bones people in a real solid world, a world where we'll do real physical things. I don't know if people will play rugby in that world. But if I want to, I'll have the body to do it. Don't know if architects will build buildings and painters paint paintings in that world. But they'll have the brains and the eyes and the hands to do it. If that's what they want to do. We just can't imagine all the pleasures, all the thrilling activities that are there for us. But we know that we will have real bodies like the body of the Lord Jesus. And we know that our bodies are going to be used to the full. And that they're going to experience pleasures and joys beyond anything we've known here in this world. Where do we start this service? Psalm 16. You will not leave my soul in Sheol. Nor allow my body to see corruption. He's going to raise us from the dead in the body to experience the pleasures that are at his right hand forevermore. And those pleasures will be for the whole of me. Spirit and body glorifying God. Spirit and body delighting in all God's goodness. Jesus has been raised from the dead. Not as a phantom, but as a real man in the body. And so will we be if we belong to him.